What's up, QAA listeners?
The fun and games have begun.
I found a way to connect to the internet. I'm sorry, boy.
Welcome, listener, to Premium Chapter 215 of the QAnon Anonymous Podcast, the Structural Anti-Semitism episode. As always, we are your hosts, Julian Field,
Sean KB,
and Lynn Vagar.
If you're a longtime listener, you've probably noticed that many of the conspiracy theories we explore end up revealing a molten undercurrent, if not a powerful geyser, of anti-Semitism. In the past, we've explored a few reasons for this tendency to exclusively blame Jewish people for the ills of our world, but this week we're aiming to go deeper into the structural aspects of modern anti-Semitism. Our guest writer is journeyman carpenter and co-host of the Antifada podcast, Sean KB, who you may remember from our episode on New Chronology and Fomenkoism. So, first off, Sean, hello, how you doing? And do you expect us to ignore that you're in the same trade as Jesus? How are we supposed to trust a carpenter on anti-Semitism?
Listen, as somebody who's on the inside of this whole thing, all I gotta say is it was the Romans, okay?
That's true.
Judas helped, but it was the Romans, okay? You can blame them.
That would be amazing if, like, you know, the entire kind of Judeo-Christian affair of being paranoid at each other for various reasons was solved by just blaming Italian people entirely. Guys, it's Italy. Let's stop fighting each other. We're brothers.
Yeah, that would be great. I mean, it's never too late, I guess, to start. So.
It's never too late to switch from anti-Semitism to anti-Italian sentiment. Yeah, how are you doing, man? Glad to have you back and excited
yeah.
to explore something. I mean, kind of grim, but I think that this is some fresh angles.
This is obviously a really fraught topic, and we're going to deal with it respectfully and be sure, you know, to acknowledge all the shittiness that goes on with this stuff. In terms of how I'm doing well. I realized that the last time that we recorded together on the New Chronology and Fomenko stuff was before the war broke out, you know, the war between Ukraine and Russia. So we were like,
oh, wow.
We were focusing on something that was, we didn't even realize how topical it was going to be when we were talking about historical revision. We were talking about like new Russian historiography, talking about greater Russia and the way that like there's going to be a lot of they in this episode when we talk about anti-Semitism, the way that they have been burying the true glory of the Russian people. So part of me hopes that this isn't as topical as that, that episode, to be honest with
you. Yes, let's hope this doesn't, you know, act as a kind of prologue for anything bad.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I don't know. Maybe you do have that sickly touch, you know? Maybe everything you touch does wither.
I don't want
the lathe of heaven.
No, that's I don't right. want the lathe. You don't want the lathe in my
Nobody
head.
Wants the lathe.
Nobody wants the lathe. That's part of the lathe, though, the lathe of heaven idea, though, right? Is that nobody really wants it, and it's given to you like a burden.
Yeah.
I think.
Spoil the child, spare the lathe. I don't know. Is that anything? All right. Well, folks, let's get into it.
Capitalism, modernity, and structural anti-Semitism.
There was already, by the 1890s, a phrase going around Austrian-German Marxist circles, widely attributed to the famous Social Democratic Party of Germany theorist and politician August Bebel, that, quote, anti-Semitism is the socialism of fools. You'll still hear this phrase bandied about sometimes, but with the recent rise of explicit and implicit anti-Semitism, I'm thinking of David Icke and his all-powerful, scheming, interdimensional lizard cabal, or truthers who believe that international bankers did 9/11, it seems like it makes sense to pose the question again, why do critiques of modernity and capitalism so often include a healthy dose of hatred of Jewish people and their alleged centrality to social change and economic exploitation? This is a question we must ask carefully. Modern anti-Semitism led to the destruction of more than 6 million lives in the mid-20th century. To explain the material or ideological origin of such an immense crime always risks the charge that one is justifying it or that its execution is understandable in some way. Nothing could be farther from the truth. Still, if we intend to understand the workings of history, we have to try to explain the emergence of the worst, most bloody ideas, lest our politics continue to suffer from them. One of the more compelling theories for why modern anti-Semitism takes such a systemic and virulent form comes from the late Canadian social theorist and historian Moishe Postone. In 1980, he wrote a short article called Anti-Semitism and National Socialism. This text was controversial because it argued that there was something deeper to the Nazi project than mere prejudice or ethnic hatred, that something about the specific social structures of capitalism and how they appear lead to the sort of ideologies that attribute attribute vast powers to a minority group that seems to be at once inside, outside, and above the rest of society. As he says in his text, quote, "No functionalist explanation of the Holocaust and no scapegoat theory of anti-Semitism can even begin to explain why, in the last years of the war, when the German forces were being crushed by the Red Army, a significant portion of vehicles was deflected from logistical support and used to transport Jews to the gas chambers. Once the qualitative specificity of the extermination of European Jewry is recognized, it becomes clear that attempts at an explanation dealing with capitalism, racism, bureaucracy, sexual repression, or the authoritarian personality remain far too general. The specificity of the Holocaust requires a much more determinate mediation in order even to approach its understanding," unquote. For Postone, it's not just a question of what happened, but what sort of social structures led to modern anti-Semitism gaining such a popular hold over European politics and society. For Postone, it was not just racism or prejudice, though it was that, of course. It was, on a deeper level, the product of an everyday mystification of the economy and how it works. To follow Postone's arguments, I'm going to have to present listeners with some pretty advanced Marxist theory, but I'll try my best to break it down into popular terms as much as possible. We'll hopefully walk away understanding the deep structural ways that capital itself distorts our own understanding of the world, and how, within the particular historical conjuncture of Germany in the early 20th century, it led to mass murder on an industrial scale. This is more than just a historical question, though. Even without a full return to Nazism, which may be an open question at this point the way things are going, are we destined always to have to confront the proposition that some great they want to use the hidden levers of power to make us live in the pod and eat the bug? What is it about the way that capitalism operates that tends towards conspiracy theories around powerful international cabals controlling human events? Why is it that anti-Semites can blame covert Jewish power for both the Federal Reserve's interest rate policies and the social policies of secret communist Joe Biden? How is it that every rightoid theory, from cultural Marxism, or the woke mind virus, or the Rothschilds, or commie scientists putting fluoride in the tap water as a brainwashing device, always seem at least tacitly anti-Semitic, or at least use the same patterns of thoughts and assumptions of how power works that anti-Semites use?
Modern anti-Semitism.
Moshe Postone argues that anti-Semitism in the 19th and 20th century was qualitatively different from the ancient religious hatreds that came before. Whereas medieval anti-Semitism was prejudiced against Jews because of the particular economic roles they were pushed to or their religious difference with the Christian majority, modern anti-Semitism is a secular theory that purports to encompass a systemic analysis of all sorts of social problems that arise in modernity. There's a huge difference between these two historical types of anti-Semitism. How do we account for the shifting terrain of ideology over the last few hundred years? The truth, as we'll see, is that capitalism, by its very nature, poses a series of real material paradoxes that all of us live with every day. It is at one time an incredibly productive system, leading to the creation of untold wealth of commodities for sale, but at the same time, one that brings vast inequalities in its wake. It sets human beings free from servitude to individual rulers, yet demands all of us be at work for an employer in the morning or be homeless. It operates through the purposive activity of individuals to buy, to sell, to save, to accumulate wealth. Yet the mechanism it does this through, the market, is beyond the control of any one person or group, even the capitalists who benefit from it. Capital at once appears as an infernal machine for financial speculation on all aspects of human life, while at the same time as the motor which drives industrial progress forward. The commodity form of wealth at the center of this system makes the things we produce and consume at once both a concrete use value we can eat or build with, but also an abstract entity that only finds its reason for being on the market. As this economic dynamism encompasses more and more of social life, this social logic becomes a battering ram that overthrows all ancient traditions, power relationships, cultures, and modes of thought. The 19th and 20th century reactionaries who birthed modern anti-Semitic ideology into the world were reacting to epochal shifts in human civilization and needed a group to represent the personification of all these things. There had to be some group that was doing all this in society, not some blind, acephalous logic magic that tore asunder the, quote, natural organic ways of life under assault by the profit system.
And enter the cosmopolitan rootless people.
Yeah.
As they like to put it.
Rootless and cosmopolitan. So, something that could be used by Stalin and Stalinists as well. So you see a little crossover appeal to this concept.
As you see on Twitter. If you're too online.
Unfortunately, yeah, we're all too online. But if you think we're getting out of this episode with large swaths of the left safe from accusations of tacit anti-Semitism, you might be surprised, but we'll get there. This group, right, had to be some segment of the new powerful bourgeois capitalist class, but not the industrial barons like Krupp or Theismann, who, after all, were making Germany great again. The evil cabal at the heart of it all had to represent the bad, speculative, globalist side of capital, one that was unrooted from the so-called Volkish community. And this is why, according to Postone, anti-Semitism shifted during capitalism's ascendancy from a prejudice and hatred of a religious minority, as witnessed in the medieval period, to a systemic and secular pseudo-critique of capitalist society in the modern period. A lot has changed since the nightmare of the 1930s and 40s, but because we still live under these paradoxes of production, we are still cursed with the same ideologies of hidden cabals and secret plots by bankers within a juxtaposition between good, national, productive industrial capital on the one hand, and corrosive, international, usurious financial capital on the other. Let's have a look at the way the capitalist system helps produce this type of baneful ideology in everyday practice.
I love the idea of the guy who's slowly waking up to a critique of capitalism, but he's like, instead of saying, you know, crony capitalism or whatever these kinds of words, he's like, well, it's the Jewish capitalism.
Right, yeah. I don't mean that anti-Semitically. I mean finance.
Yeah.
Right. Many such cases.
Yeah, so it seems like a lot of it for Postone is like that this national bourgeois class is attempting to build a modern, highly exploitative national state, but like has to deal with the negative effects of capital, but can't actually attack those negative effects because like, whoa, but that's the good thing we're trying to create.
Exactly, yeah. Because of course, and we'll get into this, this all arises at a time when the modern nation state is also arising. And so the type of modern anti-Semitism that we're going to talk about is seen all throughout Europe because like the vast social changes of bourgeois society are changing everywhere in Europe, but they're especially acute in Germany, which is underdeveloped compared to say France or Great Britain, and therefore the state necessarily has to take on a greater role, and the marriage between industrial capital and the state in this developmental schema leads, of course, as you said, to the conclusion that like there has to be a good side of this creative destruction that we can hold on to. It's just the bad side, i.e., you know, triple parentheses, finance capital, that's holding Germany back.
The fetishism of commodities and the secret thereof.
In previous historical epochs, it was pretty easy to see who the rulers were and how they ruled. Typically, it was the guy on the horse with the sword who'd come down to your strip of land and take your surplus grain you made with your tools at the end of the growing season. Or it was the slave master who drove you to work with his whip. Maybe it was the churchman who controlled the lands you worked on and demanded his tithe. It could even be the guild master who used his craft knowledge to make you live and work under him as an apprentice until you could save up enough to buy your own tools. In each mode of production, up until the present one, it was clear who made the things necessary to produce the needs of society and who it was that took whatever surplus was left over after everyone was fed, clothed, and sheltered. Now, as a side note on this medieval period, the money lender, who became associated with Jews for historically contingent reasons in Europe in the medieval period, the money lender was part of this arrangement, but existed on the margins of the feudal economy and society. Finance was a service mostly used by kings and merchants, not like today, where most Americans have a mortgage, a car loan, or student debts. By and large, in the feudal period, it was lord against peasant or slave against master. These were direct forms of extra-economic personal domination of one person over another. This only changed a few hundred years ago in a small part of Western Europe, but since Marx's time, it has become so common that all of us today are raised to see capitalism as both natural and eternal and just. That was three boaths, but you get the gist. In capitalist society, seems like everyone gets back from the system what they put in. The landlord gets rent, the capitalist gets profits, and the worker gets wages. Unlike the quote-unquote organic, natural, feudal mode of production, the surplus we make it work, day in and day out, is expropriated from us not through violence, but through markets. Sure, if you refuse to pay your property taxes, eventually a sheriff with a gun will show up and kick you out. But by and large, the mechanism by which the owners of property increase their property is through buying from us our ability to work for them. The vast majority of people on Earth have no choice but to sell their labor on the market because, unlike even the lowliest peasant in feudal times, we have no means to survive except by selling ourselves for a period of time. Being radically separated from the lands and machines that previous people owned or had access to will do that. This sets up a situation where all of us are free from old social relationships of direct domination and dependence on personal figures, but are at the same time implicated in vast networks of power shaped by the impersonal domination of markets. Capitalism is different from past modes of production because the categories money, commodity, and capital, the building blocks of the system, the things we interact with every day, necessarily obscure the determinant ways that we are all in relation to one another, including the way that the labor of the majority is appropriated by the minority who owns productive property in the form of factories, machines, and the like. Commodities, by their very nature, take the form of appearance of things when they are, in fact, the embodiment of social relationships between people. As relationships, these interactions between millions of people in the market cannot be held or touched except in their objectified forms as money, commodity, and capital. Few of us have met or could meet the African cobalt miner, the Taiwanese fab tech, the Chinese longshoreman, the American engineer in Silicon Valley, the Mexican vegetable grower who fed that engineer, or the tool and die maker who made the machine the engineer worked on, and so forth. But a small piece of all of their labor went into the phone or computer you're listening to this podcast episode on. The commodity that results from all these various labors seems to have a life of its own. Your iPhone draws labor around it, goes out into the market, sails around the world, demands a price, and so on, while you sit at home and listen to this podcast episode before you've got to go to work. The practical disconnect between the socialization of labor across space and time on the one hand and the atomized powerlessness of the worker on the other is why Marx had to reach deep into anthropology to describe the way capitalism mystifies its own operation. The commodity is like a transubstantiated wafer of bread in which the devout would claim that Christ exists. This sacrilege, this grubby materialism, drove monarchists and aristocrats and state-sponsored merchants and all sorts of people on the losing end of the transition to capitalism kinda nuts. It was tearing apart the, quote, natural organic bonds between the heavily anointed rulers and the toiling masses. It posed the question of universal rights for the first time. All were becoming equal under contract law, and money was becoming the bearer of social power, not heredity or throne. This was an especially trying time for reactionaries, boo-hoo, and the mystifications innate to capitalism drove them into fits of intellectual madness. Marx's critique of political economy, which he developed in the mid-19th century, helps explain these antinomies, but the movement for proletarian internationalism was unattractive for clerical reactionaries, junker landlords, and downwardly mobile middle classes, for obvious reasons. Reactionaries had to grasp for a more vibes-based and racist way to understand all these systemic changes happening around them.
The mystifications of capital.
So, the disconnect between the way that capital appears and how it functions is built in. This is especially salient in the twofold nature of the commodity, it being a use value and exchange value at the same time. This twofold nature is essential for understanding Marx's critique and how Poe-Stone used it to understand Nazi genocide. It would do us well to flesh this paradox out a bit, because this contradiction within the commodity form is what gives rise to the one-sided pseudo-critique of capital, very much favored by anti-Semites and reactionaries in general. In modern times, we all live and breathe under a fetish form of commodity production. Our vital powers, our creativity, our labor, our life force are subsumed into the cash nexus every day. We only have a chance to live if capital is sucking our surplus labor dry. After we made enough product to afford to buy the consumption goods necessary to live, this surplus is in the hands of the capitalist. The product of our labor leaves the sensuous material realm of production and goes into a realm where all our efforts are abstracted into the market. It is here that all the separate jobs we do, all the separate things we create at our particular workplaces, from coffee beans to tables to foundations of buildings to spreadsheets to soy lattes, are tested against one another and their unique product made interchangeable by finding themselves a quantitative price. It is in the realm of abstraction that each of our contributions are weighed against everyone else's as the product of our collective labor is bought or sold. Capital is our own labor embodied in an estranged form that demands our time and our labor to reproduce itself and in ever greater quantities. We believe the table is haunted by the spirits of the deceased because, economically speaking, it is. Capital, then, is more than just a thing, though it coheres itself in things, in machines, in transportation networks, in commodities, in factories, in agribusiness estates. Capital is a seance between living labor and past dead labor. Capital is the metamorphosis of money into capital, means of production and labor power, in a process that generates more money in the end, from concrete to abstract to concrete and back again. It's an expression of our human powers to change and remake the world, increase the wealth of human civilization, and land a person on the moon, but we have no control over it. The damn thing is spooky. In this alien entity's ruthless pursuit for self-expansion, in production for production's sake, quote, all fixed, fast, frozen relations with their train of ancient and venerable prejudices and opinions are swept away. All new-formed ones become antiquated before they can ossify, unquote, as Marx and Engels said in the Manifesto of the Communist League. The relentless pursuit of profit in new commodities, in new services, in new ideas radically alters every society that capital envelops. And in the course of remaking the economy, capital now appearing as a force of nature in opposition to the nation and civil society, old social structures and institutions fall, the modern nation-state arrives on the scene, and the liberal-conservative split within the bourgeoisie becomes the dominant mode of politics. It's no wonder, then, that fantastical ideas spring up about who is in control of this process and who benefits. We're all enthralled to the global power of an abstract and alien social machine that extracts life from us in 8-hour intervals, if we're lucky. Powerful people certainly benefit from capital, but the market that creates it, that forum for impersonal abstract domination, is ultimately out of control of even the richest of men.
And that's why they end up buying Twitter. Because even for them, it doesn't feel good.
That's right, yeah. Capitalists, no matter their morals or scruples, and we know Elon Musk doesn't have a lot of those, are compelled to don the mask of capital, just as we are compelled to pick up tools and trudge to the podcast mines to make our daily bread. Mm-hmm. In the market, that veritable force of nature, that real God to which we all must kneel, decides all of our fates in the end. To paraphrase Marx, quote, capitalists make history, but not under conditions of their own choosing.
That's right, dude. It's first AI right there.
With ChatGPT, this entire podcast will be done by a computer anyways and owned by the capitalists. So I don't even know what we're doing here. One of the things that I faced with the writing of this script here is that, as Liv knows, because she's very much, you know, in this world too, and Julian, I think you are as well, it's very difficult to put in like popular prose, these kind of very arcane and weird sounding philosophical ideas of Marx. Postone, you should link the essay for people to read, the National Socialism essay.
Yeah.
Postone does a pretty good job, honestly, of laying it out, but with a jargon that would probably put most people off. So like one of the big challenges of something like this is to try to kind of parse things out and popularize them in a way that they're understandable to people. Because I think this is important stuff. I think that like there is a way that the commodity form does generate these sort of conceptions of society, and like we're kind of cursed by it, like day in and day out.
Right. And so, I mean, in a way, the market is this kind of laundering tool where the relationships of power, you know, between those who take and those who give, let's put it that way, are basically kind of made invisible by, you know, basically feeding it all into this big machine called the market and being like, well, whatever pops out the other end is the market's decision.
The market says, right?
I didn't do it. It's not me. I'm not taking the money out of your pocket, even though it does end up in mine. And so this kind of making more confusing, I'd say, of the general relationship between those who have power and those who are exploited by them, that results in this kind of vacuum of explanations for why things are happening to us, or why we don't feel good, or why we feel exploited or alienated. And of course, I'm guessing anti-Semitism is one of those very easy, more folkish, or, you know, folkish ways of kind of filling that vacuum.
Yeah, that's right.
My vague understanding of Postone is he has this interpretation of Marx where previously existing social formations are a lot more kind of concrete, that we can't push the capitalist analysis of how labor is abstracted backwards.
Right.
But then, like, as soon as capitalism happens, it's this remarkably productive system, but one that isn't as concrete or requires this massive abstraction. And so, like, I know Marx mentions that, like, it is only really at the start of capital that even the capitalist understands really the relationship he has with labor in terms of exploiting it, that, like, eventually it just gets to this point where they see the money is going up and they're like, what do I do to increase the money?
Right. How do make line go up?
Yeah. But they don't really understand it either. They're just kind of almost this like automated process.
Yeah. Like if you take it to its conclusion, I think like past where Postone goes, but some people make this argument, capital is like this real God that becomes not just mystified in the sense that like, oh, it's obscure and we don't get it, but it's like this alien force that's like literally driving us forward. There's like this treadmill effect. And, you know, this is why talking about Postone or Marx in terms of like economics is kind of a vulgarization to begin. Because as you said, these abstractions, like the market directing and our own labor becoming this alien, estranged force from us, leads to a situation where abstract domination, like the impersonal domination of capital, becomes like its own subjective history. You know, it is the thing that is moving history forward as it like constantly overcomes all these barriers to production. And a lot of those barriers, of course, are like cultural things that we all enjoy. Many of them are cultural things that are really bad that like capital forces us to get rid of. The nation state obviously has been remarkably changed by capital even over the last like 30 or 40 years. So there's like, people should get the sense from this that there is like this overarching power that exists like above us that we do create, but it doesn't feel like we do. It feels like a force of nature that's like acting upon us.
Yeah. And that's kind of, I mean, that is why it's such a powerful kind of self-replicating system of thought. And I hear the argument very often of people that it actually aligns with some sort of like natural order in the world, right? Like survival of the fittest, or they'll use pseudoscience or even like decent scientific theories to kind of explain how actually we did design this thing, or it designed itself, but on the structure that was in some way natural. And so the defense is like, why fuck with that? When we try to manipulate it, what we get is totalitarianism. But it is interesting to kind of think of it as a kind of an AI or an idea, I guess, an idea that is working and refining itself over time to self-replicate and spread among the most people possible, right? That more people would buy in and believe.
Yeah. And I think you have to go one step further than that, like beyond even just the concept that it's an idea, because it does develop ideas. And it is now this like sort of naturalized idea of how the world works. But it's also something that is reproduced in practice, like materially between us at all times. So it's on the one hand, like a mode of thought, mode of understanding, but also at the same time, it is like a true social relationship between the people who own things and the people that don't own things. The people that don't own things, all of us, are reproducing this social relationship necessarily, because we have to every time we go back to work. So it's like, it's both material, but also has like this ideological aspect to it too.
Yeah.
And those two things arise as a totality. Like this is Postone's, one of his main points, and Marx's main points too, is that ultimately at the end of the day, you can't understand the spheres of politics and the economy and culture or whatever as separate, but that there are all these emergent properties that arise out of this particular system logic.
I do like the idea of watching the king get his head cut off by the peasants and going like, okay, next king, no head.
Yeah, I mean, that's the situation we ended up in. Yeah. And look at us now. We're all running around trying to find the head.
Whose head? Who's doing this?
Some of this sort of reminds me of like what Adorno writes about anti-Semitism, although I know Postone and like the Frankfurt School are a little different in relation to like fear and how it drives it. Because like you have like even the capitalist or like petty bourgeois, which of course are like is a class that is very associated with Nazism and fascism.
For good reason.
Yeah. But they follow kind of their ego. They attempt to control as much as possible by using the logic of this system, not really knowing much of what's underlying it. But then like they face these massive economic barriers. But I think like as they expand their power, they realize like, oh, I could get hit by an economic recession. You know, these massive economic powers that exist beyond my control can just totally wipe me out. And so there's like a fear there, but they don't really know of what. They can't really protect or insulate themselves. And so the category of like the international banker becomes a perfect perfect way of like producing the thing that is within capital and is making your life harder without actually critiquing the labor relation, because your life is built on the labor relation.
100%. We're going to get there.
Okay, right. Yeah, okay.
100%.
I think it's interesting that it basically gives someone who may be, you know, exploiting a bunch of labor and they're at the top, but they still feel somehow victimized or subjected to the market as this, like you said, like a god. It's like, well, we're all going through this together. You know, if the economy falls apart, like all of our shit's going to get bad, you know, just because I'm Bill Gates, you know, I mean, why, you know, that doesn't make me some sort of bad guy. You know, we're all going to be going through it. And so we all need to work on, you know, finding a solution to continuing and replicating the system. But it also allows them to wash their hands kind of and be like, well, there's someone above me. And it is this nebulous market god.
Right. Yeah. And just to be, and this is, that's very helpful for us to clarify something too, is that people should understand that most of this essay that I wrote, most of Postone's work is on, as Liv pointed out, like this level of abstraction, you know, where you're like, where you're abstracting away much of like actual living, breathing history, things that people did, events and personages, right? To try to get to like some inner systemic logic that exists, like that's behind or imminent to all of these different events. And as Andy, you know, my co-host on the Antifada pointed out as he, you know, helped edit this essay for me, Marx in Capital Volume 3 actually points to capitalists, industrial capitalists, actually see financial capital as sometimes as like akin to their boss. Because the people that lent them the money now are all of a sudden and like, you have to make a certain amount of profits in order to pay us back at the interest rate we demand, or you go and default at that. So even capitalists themselves, big capitalists, can feel squeezed by financial capital. And it's not like industrial capitalists and financial capitalists are the same people. Sometimes they are, but there's also fractures within that capitalist class. There's fractures within the petty bourgeoisie. And as we know, there's fractures within the working class too. The market works on all of these actors and it drives people's in different directions.
The real unity of finance and industry.
So today, just as at the time when the Protocols of the Elders of Zion forgery was created by proto-fascists in 1903 Russia, the riches and transformation of the physical world we have created confronts us like a monstrous force. Our own alienated social powers to create and remake the world are thrust up into the ethereal heights of the global market, and all of the exploitation and domination is obscured behind the historically specific economic categories of capitalist production. How is it possible for ordinary people to understand this system and the wrenching changes it produces? Turns out it's really hard. Industrial production appears to be the heir to the, quote, natural organic type of economic activity that benefits all in the past as it does today. Finance seems like a parasitic force with no connection to wealth except speculation. For this reason, progressives and conservatives alike, as upholders of the profit system, tend to see industrial production as the positive side of capital and financial firms as the negative side. But the critique of bankers and private equity alone, while plausible on the surface, has always been a poor substitute for a total critique of capitalism.
You sort of see this with the obsession with calling like baristas fake workers, where it's like, well, they're not doing the productive labor, which is ironic to be a Marxist and think that, because it's kind of problematizes that category. But this obsession with like, oh, but there are people who are kind of mooching off of the actual labor being done, and there's the, you know, because they're doing fake labor.
Well, you've pointed, I think, to one of these tendencies we see in politics over and over again, which is called productivism. The Nazis were productivists, for example. Productivism basically argues that you have productive labor and productive capital. You've got industrial workers and industrial capital who have a natural unity against all sorts of parasitic entities within the economy, like finance capital and service workers, on the other hand. And it tries to create a class collaboration, basically, like within this orbit of industrial capitalism, which is the, we have to say, like the rational kernel, or at least like the practical effect of Nazi ideas of national socialism. Yeah. It's socialism to the extent that you're creating a cooperation, of course, by destroying the mass Marxist parties, by destroying independent labor unions, by crushing workers under the boot of the state. You're creating a sort of corporatist unity between the industrial capitalist and the industrial labor for the good of the Volkish nation.
It's kind of interesting because, you know, the same way that industrial capitalists might want to kind of ignore financial social capitalism, or kind of position it outside of the realm of what they're doing, you know, as some sort of alien or outside force, is similar to the way that early anti-Semitism developed around the Christian laws against usury. And so it's like, well, yeah, actually, no, we have a good system. It's just this borrowing and lending, which has always existed, always comes with this form of doing things. But we're just going to kind of pretend that that's not actually inherent. We're going to make them live outside the city walls and be like them, you know? But it is, yeah, it's inherent.
Like there's a deep history, of course, of like the Jews in Europe during the medieval period being driven out of all sorts of other industries, artisan trades or whatever, and into what was left over as like an untouchable, like bad trade, of course, which is money lending. And that's kind of outside the scope of this entire thing. But like what Postone points to, and I think is correct, is that the echoes of that older anti-Semitism still exist in the modern anti-Semitism. In fact, it's kind of predicated on it, right? Because this idea of like the Jewish people and usury is an ancient one. It's just that where usury ends up in capitalist society is way different from what usury was in the medieval period. You know, everybody now takes out loans all the time. The fucking federal government prints like trillions upon trillions of dollars every year, and banks get it and they lend it out to everybody. And as we'll see in this next section, financial capital and industrial capital, there isn't a great split between them anymore. Within certain multinational corporations, and General Motors is an example. We found this out graphically during the 2008 financial crisis. It turns out that their financing division for their vehicles was worth more on paper than actually making the cars, but it was all part of one corporation, just different divisions.
Yeah.
So by all appearances, the heady world of finance and lending have little to do with our everyday work. Finance seems disconnected from production and negatively correlated to job creation. But as Postone points out, this viewpoint mistakes one integral part of capital for the whole. It's very easy to imagine that the American car producer or multinational agribusiness corporation or the neighborhood coffee shop are separate worlds from the speculative casino of finance, that they create something tangible, concrete, and down to earth. Just think how often bourgeois politicians from both parties talk about the divergence between Main Street and Wall Street and how they will fight for the former. This appearance of antimony is baked into the way the system works. And this appearance gives rise over and over to a one-sided critique of market society that sees the abstract monetary side of capital as destructive, usurping, and parasitic, and the concrete side in which things are made as the natural descendant of the same creative, sensuous, productive human powers that built the pyramids or the Model T. What Marx's analysis teaches us, though, and this is borne out in reality if you look at the financial composition of multinational corporations, is that the realms of industry, retail, and finance are intimately connected in a dialectical totality where money form and commodity form are different moments in the same process of accumulation.
I know Postone mentions at some point that like it's really easy to think of like, you know, money being the root of all evil, but then look at like actual commodities, like whose comparative existence is contingent upon value, you know, money, as if they're just like natural. Like, yeah, I mean, of course a $5 water bottle is like the same as, you know, $5 book or whatever. That's just how things are. That's, you know, we're trading the actual value of things.
Totally naturalized, right? As though these things have some intrinsic property of price built into them, right? That's how it appears on the market, as opposed to, again, this process where these sensuous things that we touch and hold, and let's be honest, need every single day, day in and day out. Our life is just filled with commodities because food's a commodity. Everything's a commodity. These things have this like real tangible quality to them. It appears as though price is built into them, but it's actually not, which is where we get the conception that there has to be something social about the commodity, because it can only be that way by us giving a price to it collectively.
And I mean, you know, the freak out around inflation, for example, is very funny, because it's like, well, wait a second, this was a $5 bottle of water. You can't tell me it's $6 now. It's a $5 bottle of water. And this is just going to continuously happen, where we get more and more freaked out because we're like, wait, the kind of solid foundations of how I understand the world are constantly shifting, not in my favor.
And again, outside the scope of the essay, but important to point out is, you know, we saw over the last couple of years or so, very dramatically in very important industries like food making, like baby formula, that because of so much asset inflation and fictitious capital being created, generated out of the fact that there's not a lot of profits in industry comparatively to how there used to be, capital isn't even really investing in essential things like baby formula. So if one baby formula plant, as happened, goes down in the Midwest, all of a sudden now the price of that goes up immeasurably. And in many cases, mothers with babies can't even find formula on the market anymore because, of course, like actually making those commodities is a lot harder than simply like creating money out of thin air. But that's like a longer conversation. You can listen to the Antifada for that. We talk about it all the time.
Have you thought of creating a formula startup where you take out the O and the U and the A and it's like formula or something and that could maybe solve this problem?
No, I like that. I mean, you see babies in front of cell phones all the time. Why can't they just press the formula button on the app and it just like shoots out some fake milk at them? I think that's a great idea. I think you just made your first billion.
Thank you.
No, thank you. On behalf of all the babies out there. So banks lend to businesses. Businesses pay interest to banks. Banks lend to consumers. Consumers put their savings into banks, which are then lent to businesses. Capital appears at one moment as numbers in a computerized bank account, and in another moment as giant machines in a factory. Finance and industry are each part of a total system that cannot be separated into, quote, good production versus, quote, bad speculation. After all, capital in its money form is only capital if it can reunite with its commodity form in the production process and the accumulation of more capital in production, producing more commodities and more money.
Reminds me of like, just to be very brief, Marx's critique of like Proudhon is really where a lot of this starts, where he's just like, oh.
Famous anti-Semite.
Yeah, that's true. Oh, I didn't think about that.
Wow.
Where Proudhon is just like, oh, well, we want like everyone should be workers and there just shouldn't be a boss is really basically the position he articulates. And Marx says, no, as long as you're having this form of labor in which you sell your labor for capital, which is abstracted in this way, you're going to have all of the bad stuff too, the finance capital that's going to pick up. And so there's this obsession with like, well, we want the good concrete part and then like, we'll remove the bad abstract part, but they're necessarily intertwined.
100%. And I got a little dig in at Proudhon and you can get a dig in on Bakunin for his anti-Semitism. You could point to the fact that the Cirque de Proudhon in France in the early 20th century, which was like an anarchist mutualist studying society, went on to be the birth of modern fascism itself. This is not a dig on anarchists. What it's a dig on is a one-sided pseudo-critique that sees finance as somehow separate from industrial, the good industrial capital. So it doesn't matter if you're an anarchist in the 19th century. If you go down this road, it's pulling enough of these structurally anti-Semitic strings, as we'll see, that like it kind of generates this critique. It imminently, stochastically kind of generates into this.
Happened with a lot of the syndicalists, like in Italy, for instance.
National syndicalism.
Mm-hmm.
I think it is interesting, though, how kind of seductive it is to just say, you know, well, the problem with the system is actually the speculation aspect of it. And then that leads, that can lead you kind of directly into the arms of anti-Semitism, not even because you kind of intended it that way, but just because the kind of original idea is a pretty seductive explainer.
Yeah, and it matches with, again, like we were talking about with that bottle of water or whatever, with our everyday lives, there doesn't seem anything nefarious about commodity production on the face of it, because you know, as Marx famously said, that exploitation happens behind the backs of the producer. And the exploitation of all of us in production only is really realized in the market itself when that commodity goes off to the market to be sold. So I have a little example here I put in of like modern politics and how this productive versus non-productive or industrial versus finance thing works out. So former president Donald Trump, may have heard of him, is a great example of how we deal with this antinomy of finance and industry and how it works itself out with politics. Many of Donald Trump's followers extol him as the type of old-fashioned mogul who actually builds stuff like Trump Towers and casinos and weird frozen steaks you can order in the mail. But in point of fact, as we know, he makes most of his money off borrowing against what properties he still has left and after his many bankruptcies, right? And he has these licensing agreements on valuable intellectual property like his own name. So even somebody who appears, again, to represent this separation between, say, like, I just throw out a banker like Jamie Dimon of Goldman Sachs versus like a strong builder like Donald Trump, who's in the real economy or whatever. It's not so simple. It's more of a vibe. You know what I mean? It's more of like a political vernacular.
This is vaguely similar, but I remember like some blue check Twitter users being like super distraught to see Elon Musk spoke at the World Economic Forum. It's like, what do you expect? Yeah. What, like?
No, yeah. This is again like a sidebar, but I think it's an important, Musk is a very important figure to point out, because why is it that he is seen as like the Iron Man type figure? Why is it that he is seen as like a good and progressive in like a economic sense capitalist? It's because he quote unquote still builds things, right? He's got SpaceX, he's got the Boring Company, he's got Tesla. He appears, of course, to be like the sort of archetype of a 19th century like crusading individual capitalist who goes out there and actually makes stuff and gets stuff done or whatever. And that is true, and it's also untrue for the same reasons that Donald Trump is part of it, right? Of course, like Musk relies on financing as much as anybody else and gets all sorts of, you know, various different breaks and makes all sorts of money off of speculation, blah, blah, blah. But the point of it is that these sort of evocative senses of like what good capital is versus bad capital that's in this essay and that Postone talks about, these are real world examples where we can all see these operating in certain individuals like Trump or Musk, right? We can see how this bevy of like millions of nerd fanboys of Elon Musk are drawn to him because he takes on the qualities. He dons the mask of an industrial capitalist, which is something that like capitalists are supposed to be. Why aren't capitalists like Elon Musk anymore? Really wish they'd just, you know, be more like Musk.
Yeah, to be clear, he's not really building anything with the Boring Company. He's basically unbuilding the ground. Like he's taken away.
He's taking away, and he's also, as it turns out, personally undermining plans for public transportation in California.
Mm-hmm.
That's what he did with his Boring Company. He used it in order to like undermine the high-speed rail system out there.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty brilliant stuff, man. Unproductive, if you ask me. For all intents and purposes, finance and industry, money and commodities appear to be in opposition because one is abstract and the other is concrete. It is this contradiction that gives surface plausibility to the pseudo-critique of conspiracists going on about international bankers and or the one-sided critique of financial speculation by the right. It is a trap that many on the left fall into as well. It shouldn't be surprising that when Matt Taibbi made his famous quip in 2008 about Goldman Sachs being, quote, a great vampire squid wrapped around the face of humanity, relentlessly jamming its blood funnel into anything that smells like money, unquote, that someday he would turn into a social reactionary.
Or a great writer.
Or a great writer, depending on where you stand on the Taibbi question. I don't subscribe to a Substack. Maybe you guys do.
Oh, no. I was just joking that, like, he basically sounds like a fantasy writer here.
Yeah. No, I mean, he sounds like Marx, to be quite honest. But he's talking about this in finance terms, right? So, like, all of a sudden he goes off on this tangent of, like, social reaction. And people should look and think, like, wait, maybe the things that seem progressive when we had this great financial crisis 15 years ago or so, and some of these good progressives who stood up and railed against finance, is it a surprise that eventually they turn out against one aspect of capitalism, but like, you know, obviously in favor of the others? Because I don't think Matt Taibbi these days is calling for the expropriation of the expropriators.
No.
Certainly calling for an end to like trans rights and stuff, whatever the fuck he's up to nowadays.
I do like the implication, or I don't like the implication, that like the 21st century Cirque du Pudon is like, they're like Substack writers now.
They probably are, though.
Yeah.
I hate to say it, but they probably are. And they might actually gravitate around Taibbiism.
Yeah.
We don't even know.
God damn.
We'll see how topical this episode is. The metamorphosis of capital creates the appearance of contradiction between concrete and abstract, not merely in the minds of observers, but in the obscure workings of the self-valorization process itself. Never mind that exploitation of labor happens in the industrial process and in the service sector and in the transportation of commodities, and that finance is just the most glaring manifestation of a system of abstract domination over labor. Ideologies, even the most perniciously racist and foolish ones, have to seem to have some relation to our topsy-turvy economic world to have some purchase, and the one-sided pseudo-critique fits the bill.
Capital and genocide.
It is a frightening proposition that a blind, human/inhuman, subjectless system can give rise to such world historic shifts in human life as seen over the last few centuries by the complex means of its inner logic to accumulate for accumulation's sake. Say that one 10 times fast. It scares many people, even on the left, because it raises troubling questions about our own power and agency. Imagine what this alien process can do to break the brains of people accustomed to the supremacy of strong leaders. And the virtue of those, quote, ancient and venerable prejudices and opinions Marx talked about being constantly swept away by modern capitalism. By and by, within this process of accumulation, human desires and needs are being transformed. Cultures are changing, family structures are undermined, and individuals given the freedom to craft their own lives in ways unimaginable to people in the past. Reactionaries are forced to reckon with this in distorted and violent ways because a system logic cannot be assaulted or shot at or arrested. And anyways, upholding private property is mostly what they do. No wonder they're tied into intellectual knots. So this is the analogy that Postone makes in trying to understand why modern anti-Semitism came to take on such an all-encompassing and genocidal character, why it was of a systemic and secular character, not just old-fashioned prejudice. Just as abstract value only becomes concrete when embodied in the concrete form of the commodity, so too did fascist reactionaries need to find a real-world personification for all the wrenching economic, political, and social changes wrought by industrial capitalism. As Postone says, quote, "The Jews were not seen merely as representatives of capital, in which case anti-Semitic attacks would have been much more class-specific. They became the personifications of the intangible, destructive, immensely powerful, and international domination of capital as an alienated social form." National socialism was the culmination of a widespread revolt on the parts of elites and the reactionary middle classes as soon as the first bourgeois revolutions in America and France burst forth in the late 18th century. Capital brought with it new ideas of nationhood, citizenship, equality under the law, and liberty, but it also brought total war, mass immiseration, and class struggle. Nazism opposed itself to the disruptions caused by capitalist modernity, like urbanization, decadent culture, modern art, jazz, and homosexuality. Most fundamentally, it arrayed itself against both the global plutocratic capitalist imperialism of Great Britain and the global proletarian movement against capitalism itself. After all, the workers of the world, but especially the proletariat of Germany, had to have been tricked by an evil cabal to join en masse a socialist movement predicated on realizing international universal values of solidarity and justice, right? This contradiction, Jews as bearers of both finance, capital, and Bolshevism, is impossible to understand unless we see that Jews represented, Pace Postone, quote, "a foreign, dangerous, destructive force undermining the social health of the nation," unquote, as personifications of the abstract side of accumulation. The anti-Semitism that arose in the 19th and 20th century is a descendant, as we were saying earlier, of often violent medieval prejudices about Jewish connections to usury that led to expulsions and pogroms across Europe, but it is not the same in its ideology or its practice. Modern anti-Semitism is secular and systemic because a secular and systemic mode of production requires exactly that kind of villain to appear in the minds of reactionary detractors of it. Postone says, quote, "The Jews were identified not merely with money, with the sphere of circulation, but with capitalism itself. However, because of its fetishized form, capitalism does not appear to include industry and technology. Capitalism appeared to be only its manifest abstract dimension, which in turn was responsible for the whole range of concrete social and cultural changes associated with the rapid development of modern industrial capitalism," unquote. Even the big industrial capitalist often sees himself as a productive member of society against the ruthless financiers at BlackRock, who seem like a parasitic boss to him.
It seems like Postone's account of anti-Semitism is that it's purely projection, right? It has absolutely nothing to do with Jewish people themselves. And so it's kind of wrong place, wrong time as to why it's specifically Jewish people that are associated with this.
Yeah, I'm no expert on this, but my understanding is that similar types of structurally anti-Semitic pogroms and attacks on an ethnic minority took place in Southeast Asia against the Han minority of Chinese, basically settlers who went off and spread them themselves through the Philippines and the Indonesia, because they became, as for historically contingent reasons, the Jewish people in Europe became, they were the main traders, they were the main money lenders, they were the main minority in this case that was, again, outside of the rest of the productive sphere and was doing the money lendering. So a lot of revolutionary violence, a lot of brutal pogroms happened against Han Chinese people in Southeast Asia because they too fit the bill of this personification of the bad sides of capital when capital arises.
Right, like in Indonesia, it was explicitly anti-communist killings that are attached with it, I guess, right?
Yeah. So the Han Chinese can be both the bearers then of capital, but also the bearers of Chinese Bolshevism.
Interesting.
So there we have another nice little neat analogy we can make between these things. Under National Socialist ideology, the all-encompassing Volkish state run on the Führer Prinzip, the uber individual in control of all social life, was meant to be the antidote to the contradictions of capitalist development and modernity. But in their stupid, racist, one-sided pseudo-critique, the Nazis thought they could eliminate the impurities from the, quote, racial community and uphold the concrete side of the relation through industrialization for war and genocide. Their anti-Semitism was not incidental to their ideology, and the dispassionate prosecution of the Holocaust was not a mere measure of war. The destruction of the Jewish people in Europe was industrial logic applied to genocide, meant to free the, quote, Aryan race from the curse of those claimed to embody universalism, globalism, and abstraction. It wasn't a mere culture war, and it wasn't a cynical ploy to get the German working and middle classes behind World War. It was an integral part of a reactionary movement that fought a bloody war, first in the streets of Germany and then on the battlefields of Eastern Europe against Marxist internationalists, behind whom allegedly stalked the ever-powerful Jew.
Structural anti-Semitism, conspiracism, and the dissident right.
As we all know, the Nazi scourge was defeated in war in 1945 at the cost of somewhere between 70 and 85 million lives. The Holocaust lives on in our memories, rightfully, as probably the greatest crime against a whole people in all of human history. While prejudice against Jews still exists, of course, anti-Semitic reactionary revolutionary ideologies like Nazism have been thoroughly discredited in the liberal West, at least for now. Yet everywhere you look, there still exist pale reflections of the same sort of anti-Semitic ideology, even if the practitioners aren't necessarily calling on people to get, quote, woke to the JQ, although those assholes seem to be on the rise as well. The paradoxes or antinomies of capitalist production, the appearance of capital in its fragmentary and paradoxical industrial and financial form still exists because, of course, capitalism still exists. All fixed, fast, frozen relations are still being swept away in civil society and politics. We see this today as people, especially young people, are taking their freedom from old bonds to revolutionize what it means to be free from old ideas of gender and family and race and nation. Growing ranks of reactionaries in the West, and let's be honest with ourselves, many leftists have picked up the same type of one-sided pseudo-critique of finance capital that led to Nazism. If there is a materialist explanation for recent phenomena like QAnon, MAGA conspiracists, and the like, it probably arises from the crisis tendencies of capital over the last few decades. Since the stagnation of the 1970s, the abstract international financial side of capital appears to have grown at the expense of industrial capital. Big private equity firms like BlackRock, Vanguard Group, and others are buying up single-family homes to extract rents and medium-sized businesses to create efficiencies through redundancies and layoffs. Multinational corporations stride the globe seeking profits, leaving whole deindustrialized regions in their wake. Even big industrial outfits, as we mentioned before, like General Motors, have financial departments bigger on paper than their factory operations spread out across five continents. This growth of finance actually shows the weakness of capitalist growth in the manufacturing sphere and the necessity for the inflation of various asset bubbles to prop the system up. But the point remains that it's easy for critics on the left and the right to finger finance per se as the culprit in all the ways that life is getting worse for workers in the relatively wealthy but incredibly unequal capitalist core.
By the way, I will be teaching a course on fingering finance. finger finance, sorry.
That's behind the paywall, right? Probably have to be. In place of discredited Nazi racial theories, but still needing some concrete personification of the bad side of capital, the MAGA movement, dissident right, etc., have come to fixate either on some amorphous they, as in, this is what they took from us, they want you to live in the pod and eat the bug, or on representatives of the international financial side of capital, like the World Economic Forum or the Globo Homo Left. George Soros, of course, is the perfect manifestation of the one-sided pseudo-critique because he's a financer and an advocate of Karl Popper's liberal open society philosophy and a Holocaust survivor. So blaming Soros can satisfy both the outright anti-Semites and the merely structural anti-Semites. No matter the differences in emphasis, the structure of dissident right ideology is largely the same as Nazi anti-Semitism. There is a dark conspiracy afoot where myriad social changes can only be the result of conscious design on the part of a hidden global elite with their tendrils in every pocket. The brute reality, the one that structural anti-Semites can't countenance, is that capital's inhuman logic of self-expansion is colonizing more and more of social life. That disruption of norms and traditions is an integral part of its system logic. This is too daunting an idea for them to get their heads around. And this state of affairs also leads to a conclusion that scares the shit out of them. The only way to stop the revolutionizing effects of the infernal machine is through a revolution to overthrow it, to take control of humanity's destiny through conscious planning of the way we produce and reproduce society. Many of the people drawn to structurally anti-Semitic conspiracism are small business owners or small property owners or functionaries of capital. So it's not just false consciousness. They have a real stake in capitalism's continuation. Therefore, their critique can only be one-sided if they are to keep their tenuous hold on whatever passes for their petty power under this mystifying mode of production. So every time you see somebody in the media going on about the World Economic Forum or the cathedral or Soros or the regime or whatever, remember where this sentiment comes from. These ideologies are Nazi-like at their very base, while the roots of their one-sided pseudo-critique are a dangerous manifestation of how the mystification of social relations is built into capitalism itself. None of this absolves reactionary assholes of their beliefs or their actions, but it helps to explain how such shitty ideas keep coming back over and over and over and over again through modern history. If we seek an end to these pernicious ideologies, we must fight them day in and day out in the realm of politics, but ultimately, and this is my editorial here, we must unite to put an end to the perverse social system that throws up intellectual vomit such as this all the time through its occult, paradoxical antinomies.
QAA does not endorse a full-on revolution. We are not encouraging people to insurrect and overcome the government today or tomorrow.
Also, the World Economic Forum is good, and we like it.
Yeah. World Economic Forum-based, cathedral-based, Soros-based, the regime-based. Oh, you guys hear about this regime thing? I think it's like a Mencius mold bug thing.
Yes, yes, of course. And I try to basically only make oblique jokes in the direction of Dime Square because I just think it is such profoundly artistically void and also kind of obviously politically a kind of empty space. But, you know, they're out there and they keep fucking doing it. And I don't know. I mean, a lot of rich people are interested.
At least in the 20th century, they had like Ezra Pound, you know, like they have nothing.
Yeah. So true, man.
I'm starting a new conspiracy theory and like personification of the bad side of capital. And the culprit is going to be Red Scare. They got their hands in everyone's pockets. They're controlling things behind the scene.
That's true. I mean, I guess that's just anti-Russian liberalism, you know? I mean, we can do
it. No, you're right. Yeah. I've fallen in on last episode and this episode back into anti-Russianism. I can't believe I did that. Variations on a theme.
One interesting thing with Poston as well is his like position on a lot of leftists too. As you mentioned, there's like an inclusion. One modern example I can think of is like the belief that like Israel decides American foreign policy and not like the reverse. Because like, you know, America, to greatly simplify, is like an ally to Israel because it's profitable. They're selling them, you know, and as soon as it isn't profitable, why would American, you know, diplomats would change their policy? The idea that like to have like a material analysis and think this really, really small nation has infected American politics and like has the largest global superpower in the world by the balls is like a really weird and lazy kind of attempt that just happens to target. Not to say, obviously, there are valid criticisms of America's relationship to Israel.
But they're plausible on their face. If you buy into this idea that like capitalism has to have, and capitalist politics has to have some personage behind the scenes that does these things, it has to be all these changes that you see happening in politics or whatever. They could be like the workings out of like the global market and global empire. where there are contingent factors of different politicians fighting each other for different, you know, ideas and different policies or whatever. But like, of course, like you said, it's lazy, but it's plausible for dipshits to be like, well, it's a Zionist occupied government. You know, one of the funniest memes is like the anti-Semites on Twitter, and there's a lot of them. These aren't structural anti-Semites. These are anti-Semites just, you know, they love to put these memes like where they show all the different people in the Biden administration who are of Jewish background or show all the bankers high up in banks who are of Jewish background. One of the funniest memes I've seen is people do the same, have done the same thing, but for Irish people.
Yes.
You know, like you substitute, like if you start looking for all the Irish people in like the realms of high finance and the World Economic Forum and American government or whatever, you know, you could plausibly make the argument that an Irish cabal is behind the scenes doing all this malarkey.
Hibernian occupied government.
Hog. We live under the hog. I hope this was all clear. I mean, you guys
jumped in with
some good clarifying stuff too. I think that like there's a way that Postone in his life and in this essay and his work in general like goes really far in certain directions, probably too far. Like he's very much a figure of the new left. He's very much a person who was the son of a rabbi and ended up actually taking his PhD in Germany during the 1960s, part of like this like student movement sort of thing or whatever, and had lost faith in, say, the Soviet project. So one of the things he tries to do in like Time, Labor, and Social Domination, which is his magnum opus, is he tries to basically say that there's something that the Soviet, that actually existing socialism also worked on these same principles of like abstraction, that the two are actually like historically connected with one another, which is an interesting thesis. But I think he's maybe ex post facto tries to do that because of his political rejection of the Soviet Union, if you know what I mean. So there's plenty of parts where it's like easy to disagree with Postone. But I think that this theory has been very helpful for me over the years on the podcast and just talking with people or whatever to try to understand like why, again, even when these things aren't like naming the Jew or whatever these fucking dipshits do, it's still always about these cabals. It's still always about this hidden power. It's still always about bankers and whether they come out and say it's like Jewish bankers or not, it's still the same sort of concept. So it helps, this theory, I think, helps us to understand how capital itself, through its mystification, kind of generates this over and over again. And it's something that we're forced to live with till we get rid of it.
Yeah, and how like in the contemporary period, a lot of the kind of lazier leftists who like really explain everything through conspiracism and individual actors making things as opposed to broader structural analysis do have a possible tendency of moving towards anti-Semitism as they have in the past historically.
100%. Yeah, 100%, which is why it's important for people like who listen to the show and all of us who are on the left too to like isolate these things and like not, of course, justify how these people end up in left field and like anti-Semitic wasteland, but like see the patterns of thought that lead even presumably people of good conscience on the left down these paths towards making Israel like the number one wellspring of like injustice in the entire world or whatever.
All right. Well, thanks so much, Sean. Where can people find you in your work?
Oh, yeah. The Antifada podcast. You can find us wherever podcasts are free or on patreon.com/theantifada. Find me on Twitter at @as_a_worker, as a worker. And yeah, I'm around, man. Check it out. Check me out.
Go and check me him out.
Check me him out. That's right.
Thank you for listening to another premium episode of the QAnon Anonymous podcast. We appreciate you supporting us and allowing us to stay advertising free and editorially independent. Liv, where can people find your stuff?
I have a Twitch stream that I'm going to start doing a lot more soon, just twitch.tv/LivAgar, and a podcast that is sort of philosophy, politics related called LivAgar, available wherever podcasts are hosted. Yeah.
Awesome. And for everything else, we've got a website. It's QAnonAnonymous.com.
Listener, until next week, may the deep dish bless you and keep you.
It's not a conspiracy, it's fact.
And now, today's auto cue.
The institutions of mainstream media and academia all seem to move at the same pace, in the same direction, as if they were all reading from the same doctrine at the same speed. It's as if they were all working together. But that's where we run into our first big misconception about just what the cathedral is. And that is the accusation that the cathedral is just another spin-off the old shadow government conspiracy theory. This is the most common straw man you will get when trying to explain the concept of the cathedral to your average normie. and it couldn't be further from the truth. The Cathedral is in fact, if anything, an anti-conspiracy theory. It seeks to explain how this cohesive narrative of wokeism can actually arise from a completely decentralized force. No one single group or individual is in charge of the Cathedral. There are some who have more influence than others, but no one is 100% in control of this beast, or anywhere close to it. In other words, this theory is a logical explanation to show how what seems to be a global conspiracy is in fact something very different. Or as Moldbug puts it, the mystery of the Cathedral is that all the modern world's legitimate and prestigious intellectual institutions, even though they have no central organizational connection, behave in many ways as if they are a single organizational structure. And this is where things start to get a little complex, because it proceeds to the question, how in the heck is the Cathedral able to operate as such a seemingly cohesive unit that moves in one direction for controlling narratives if there is no central authority?